This week I got to talk with Nick Kolakowski about his LA noir, Where the Bones Lie. If you know anything about me, you know LA and noir are two of my favorite things to have in a book, so I was super excited to dive into this one. For Dash Fuller, Hollywood's underbelly is home. He spent years making the film industry's worst secrets disappear, and it's left him a cynical burnout with a taste for bourbon and self-loathing. But when a young woman comes to him with a peculiar quest, Dash sees a chance at redemption. Madeline Ironwood is the daughter of Ken Ironwood, a notorious smuggler and murderer who disappeared 20 years ago. Ken's skeleton has just been discovered in a barrel at the bottom of a dried-up lake, and Madeline wants to know who killed him. Dash agrees to help, and as this desperate daughter and jaded cynic claw their way through a world of sun-bleached secrets, crooked cops, and Hollywood thugs, they soon uncover a conspiracy involving some of LA's most powerful people. I flew through this one. Like, I just had to know how it was all going to work out. It has a really fun, darkly comedic voice. It's a little bit satirical about LA and Hollywood as an industry. And Madeline, pretty cool. I want a friend like Madeline, basically. So, that being said, let's hear from Nick. I am super excited to talk about Where the Bones Lie, but I did want to get to know a little bit about you first and kind of like your journey as an author. So when did you know you wanted to write a book, or what was your moment that you were like, I think I want to be an author or a writer?
So I think I fall into that same bucket as a lot of writers, where when I was a little kid, I liked to write and illustrate my own stories. And granted, those stories were like, you know, 10-page adaptations of Mega Man or whatever Super Nintendo game I was playing at the time, but I still had that impulse. And that just sort of laddered up to writing. Not that what little kids do isn't right, because it's often creative and fun and really cool, but and then inevitably you kind of go through the teenage phase where you write stuff that you just subsequently want to shred. Even though at the time you think it's brilliant. And then I became a journalist because that seemed to be the easiest way to get paid to write, you know, and kind of consistently keep a roof over my head. And then I kind of dropped off writing fiction, though, for a really long time, like throughout my 20s. And I only, when I got into my 30s, then I decided, not really it's now or never, but just kind of you have this impulse that doesn't really ever go away. And I finally decided to kind of put my shoulder to it and then started writing books. And because from a young age, I always loved crime novels and horror novels. Mm-hmm. Like I grew up on Raymond Chandler and Stephen King and Agatha Christie and Clive Barker and people like that. And then that's inevitably when I started writing regularly, that's where I ended up, and that's why we're here. And I bounce regularly as a writer between crime fiction and horror, and people keep telling me to settle on one and build an audience around one, and I just can't do it. I keep going between the two. Where the Bones Lie is obviously detective fiction, so for this book at least I whacked on one.
It is interesting because there are, I think it's cool when authors are able to like write different genres. It's kind of fun just seeing different takes in different genres. So it sounds like horror and crime fiction was what you were reading growing up. Is there something that drew you to writing it or reading it? Like, is there stuff you love about those genres?
I think, I mean, with crime fiction, it was always the voice of it. And also just I was kind of a very bookish, cerebral kid growing up, and the idea of, you know, for example, Agatha Christie or any of those really old school mystery authors, like, you know, in the locked room genre authors of like the 1920s and so on, having a hero or an anti-hero who could solve stuff using their brain was enormously attractive. And I think that that's sort of what pulled me into a lot of mystery fiction. And then, I mean, with horror fiction, it is mostly sort of a sense that, I mean, granted, horror explores like the darkness, but it's also showing you that there's sort of like a world kind of beyond yours. When you read Clive Barker or anyone else, you know, who kind of pushes the bounds and kind of makes you realize that, you know, whatever your narrow frame of mind is, it's just been expanded, even if it's in terrible ways, like you suddenly kind of get right. I still get that feeling when I read, like, Cassandra Kaw is one of my favorite authors, you know, and they bounce regularly between horror and sci-fi and so on, like the all-consuming role in those books. Every time I read one of their books, like, my mind blows up in the same way. So, yeah. I still get that feeling. It's pretty continual thing from then to now in that sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I can't believe I've never, when you were saying, like, the idea of someone who can solve something with their brain is appealing, I'm like, duh, of course that's why I'm going to tell people why I love thrillers now. But also kind of like magic box type, or not magic, puzzle box type books I really end up loving. And I feel like I'm always like so engaged in them. And it probably is because I'm like, oh, my brain alone could maybe figure this out.
Yeah, it's also with thrillers. I mean, the other author that I fell in love with early on, I still really love, in fact, I just reread Strangers on a Train, is Patricia Highsmith. And that's sort of a slightly different way of using one's brain, because inevitably the protagonists of her books like do horrible things, but it's a lot of fun. And I've always found it very inspirational to have a hero who gets themselves in trouble and then has to use their brain to like kind of figure their way out of it. And they're trying to think three or four steps ahead of everyone else. Inevitably, there's, at least in the context of mystery fiction, there's always a detective or someone like that who's also trying to play this chess game with them. So that's what I've always loved, Patricia Highsmith stuff. There's so many great stories about her as an author as well.
Oh, really?
She was a complete misanthrope. And she used to do things like show up to parties with like her pet snails and everything, like publishing parties. Like, she was really,
oh my gosh.
and at one point, I mean, to be a fly on this particular wall, another crime fiction author I really love is Chester Himes, who wrote these great Harlem set mystery novels, probably around like the 1940s, 1950s, like in that era. And he was also a huge misanthrope. And I guess, but Patricia Highsmith and him were also really great friends, and they used to take road trips together.
That's cool.
So you have like these two extraordinarily angry misanthropic authors like trapped in a car together, like going cross country to like writing conventions or whatever in the 60s, when it was not really a great time to, you know, necessarily be driving through the South as like, you know, as a woman and a black man together. And like, it's amazing to think about that. Just, yeah. Anyways, that's
complete cool. aside. But
yeah.
You're reminding me that I need to like, or that it would be fun, not like I have to learn more about just like authors of the past. I love those stories. One thing I had to ask though, because you said Strangers on a Train, have you read Stephen Cavanaugh's Kill for Me, Kill for You?
I have not. I know him.
Okay.
That is a gap in my, I guess, bibliography of him. I need to, though.
I read it last year, and it is my favorite, most unique take on the Strangers on a Train approach. He like really has such a unique take on it. So anytime I hear about it, I'm always talking about his book now.
Okay.
It's really good. It's very dark. Naturally.
So. Yeah, of course, given him. Yeah, yeah. That's inevitable. It's really funny because so many people have done variations on that theme because it's such a kind of an evergreen great plot. And sometimes you see people carry it off, but it's encouraging to hear that he really carried it off because, I mean, you do read things and it doesn't quite work. So the fact that he's also a master. So the fact that he nailed it is inevitable,
right?
Maybe in a certain way. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, the part that's unique, what's crazy too, when I read it, I was talking to one of my friends and she like sent me an interview with him, and his wife had the idea for the part that makes it so unique. So thank you to her, I guess is what I'm saying. Because it is, I'm always like, okay, I've heard this idea before, but obviously tropes work in different ways sometimes. But I remember getting, I think it's like the 50 or 60% point and you're like, oh, okay, this is what's going on. So it's pretty cool.
He's good at that. I mean, but he's also done such great things. Like, I mean, courtroom thrillers used to bore me to absolute friggin' tears. And that's nothing about the genre. Like, I mean, there are great examples of it. I'm not denigrating in any way, shape, or form. It's just in terms of my personal preferences. But I mean, he's really good at doing that too. He's good at taking those genres with all those tropes and being like, okay, I'm going to filter this through my
Totally.
Style. And it's going to work out perfectly. Like, what was that one book? 50-50?
50-50. I haven't read it yet, but I just got it on NetGalley because it's releasing in the US or the States or whatever here soon. I'm super excited for that one too.
So, he's
great. That one will be good. What's your writing process like? Do you typically outline? Do you know where you're headed with the story? How do you approach it?
So I'm a pantser. So I mean, to anyone listening, I assume everyone listening being writerly and readerly knows what that means. But it would go kind of on gut instinct, and that would always end up being problematic simply because inevitably the muse can help power you to finish a book, but the problem is that book might not be very good in terms of the first draft. And you have to go back and like do really radical revisions to it. With Where the Bones Lie, this is the first book I actually outlined. And the interesting thing is that when I outlined it, I was like, okay, like this is going to ease the rewriting process. You're not going to go through all this stress and trouble. You're not going to have to bash your way through five drafts to like kind of figure out the nodes of the story. And the irony was that I think I ended up rewriting this just as extensively as a pantser book because my outline doesn't align with the final book. And as I was writing based off the outline, I was like, okay, this doesn't work. Cause you're still sort of feeling your way along a little bit.
Right.
And I'm sure anyone who outlines regularly could tell you that. And it seems like a very obvious fact, but I didn't know it. So all of a sudden I'm like, wow, this actually, it's kind of helping, but it's also kind of not.
I feel like that's kind of what I've realized the more authors I've talked to is like, is the fact that even when you're outlining kind of what you're saying, you're still having to come up with the ideas out of nothing. Like you're just like doing it before you like write it long form, but it is like, you're still having to like think on the fly, even if you're building an outline. I'm like, okay, so there's no way to just like completely know exactly how to start out writing your book.
The best advice I've ever gotten, I haven't done it yet. I just want to, and that's, I think it's mostly because I, in order to do it properly, you need a whiteboard, and I just don't have if I were to reverse the camera around, you would see my office, which also serves as our storage room and everything else. I'm kind of squeezed in, too squeezed. But my friend Rob Hart, who's the writer of Assassins Anonymous, The Warehouse, and a bunch of those books, has this great technique. Now, he's mentioned this before at conferences and so on, so I don't think I'm spoiling anything in terms of like the writing process. But he gets a whiteboard, and he does the entire outline of the book on it down to like the second and third tier bullet points, like character details, everything like that, has it all arranged, spends lots of time on it. And then he erases it all, like just, and he forces himself to do it from memory. And his theory is that what you retain in your head and what like is sort of still preserved when you do it again, like without any notes or anything like that, is the stuff that's worth keeping. And it requires you to really have a kind of trust in your own instincts about like what works and what doesn't, and sort of a trust that your memory and your creative instincts and so on are all in alignment. And he does. I mean, he's written so many books and short stories and awards and blah, blah, blah at this point. But I always thought that was a fascinating way to do it because it's people agonize over like, what should I cut? Is this valuable or whatever? And his technique, I think if you do it right, like just kind of vaporizes all that and gets right to what's important, hopefully.
That makes a lot of sense. Because it's like what stuck with you, the person who like has to write the book now. That's cool. I love Rob Hart. I think Paradox Hotel might still be my favorite sci-fi book ever. I'm still chasing the high of reading the Paradox Hotel. And I just got the Medusa Protocol, which is the second one for Assassins Anonymous. I'm so excited for that. He has some cool writing tips is what I'm learning the longer I talk to him and other authors, actually.
He was one of the inspirations for this book. So in Where Do Bones Lie, the main character, Dash Fuller, and the young woman he partners with, Madeline Ironwood, are amateur detectives, although that's kind of too much of a negative term, but they're people who are just kind of figuring out how to detect a case. Or solve a case, rather. And I took a lot of inspiration from Rob because Rob, before Paradox, which is an amazing, amazing book, and before Warehouse, also an amazing book, did the Ash McKenna series, which is basically kind of the Batman Begins in a certain way of detective mm-hmm. books, like, because Ash McKenna, the character, starts out as not a dumb person, but like certainly somebody who's more inclined to use their fists and not really think things through. And by the end, he's a pretty seasoned detective, and you have this whole character arc. So I took a lot of inspiration from that in terms of like how to think about an evolving and emerging detective.
Right. I love that. And I love the noir genre as well, just in general. It's so fun. And that's obviously a part of this one. What was it like? So it sounds like you kind of took inspiration from actually Ash McKenna is what we're saying. But mm-hmm. what was it like kind of like diving into that noir vibe with this one?
It was so that I think it was a little complicated, and I love mm-hmm. the genre, but the genre is also one of there's so many kind of barnacle crusted cliches that have emerged with crime fiction, mystery fiction, and noir fiction over the years. And I wanted to do that. There's sort of this delicate dance where on one hand, the people who come to the genre as readers expect a certain amount of those tropes. There's a familiarity to them. There's a comfort to them. It's the blanket on a cold night with a cup of tea, you know, and people want that. But on the other hand, people inevitably are attracted to new things, and they want, you know, things that kind of twist on that genre. And as a writer, you also want to twist on that genre as well. You just, I mean, some people do a good job of like kind of playing the hits, but I think for most writers, you want to kind of do something new. So I found myself in this position where I wanted to write something that was kind of a bit of an homage to traditional California mm-hmm. detective mystery, but on the other hand, also played with kind of those tropes and so on. Mm-hmm. And the biggest one I really wanted to tackle was there's a tendency within not so much detective fiction, but much more kind of broader noir, you know, and hard-boiled fiction mm-hmm. where you have a character who's kind of in a tailspin, they're on a descent. And like the whole point is that the, you know, the cruel dark world crushes them like a submersible, you know, like into, you know, by the end of the book, they're completely destroyed. And I wanted to write a book that was a bit of a subversion of that, where the character's mm-hmm. arc wasn't bending towards destruction so much as towards, I'm going to use a therapy term here, like self-actualization or something like that. Mm-hmm. And healing for both of them, for both Madeline and for Dash. And it then two people who kind of want to make themselves better and kind of heal in their broken places. So that was a big driver. And I wanted to do without getting too pedantic. But and I think all writers confront this, you know, in terms of, it's like what you're talking about, Steve Kavanaugh, like where it's like you want to give people what they want in the courtroom drama, but you also want to do something new on it too. So there's that.
Yeah, totally. That was something that was different that I did notice, where Dash especially is kind of like reevaluating what he's done in the past and then what that could mean for his future, like how he could kind of still use the skills maybe in a different way. So that is a lot different. When you were saying the like tailspin, it was also reminding me of Jessica Jones, the Netflix series, was like such a good example of that. Like like her life is just always falling apart. Like just like everything's going wrong. So it was kind of cool seeing more of a character arc, because you don't always see a character arc in like some crime fiction. Mm-hmm. But with both Dash and Madeline, they both felt like very fleshed out, very like aesthetic too. Like Madeline has a very specific aesthetic. What was it like building those characters?
Madeline is actually based a little bit on me when I was younger. I also walked around in a massive navy greatcoat just like she does, and I was also like kind of acerbic and trying to figure stuff out and so on. So a lot of her details are actually me.
That's cool.
In a lot of ways.
I was googling greatcoat at the beginning. I was like, okay, now I know.
So I had one. My grandfather had his one that was issued to him in World War II as the part of the Navy. When I was a teenager, I found it in a closet, and it became like sort of like Madeline does, like kind of my armor to the world. I was walking around in this huge Navy greatcoat. And like, so a lot of her is me. I'm not quite as impulsive as she is. Like she likes to do things like drive dangerously and you know, kind of get in people's faces. I'm not quite at that level, but definitely that is sort of filtered through. And Dash is, so as part of the whole journalism thing, for a long time, I was a celebrity interviewer and like a entertainment journalist. And so I spent a lot of time in LA and Vegas, like interviewing celebrities and doing that whole circuit. And you end up running into a lot of PR people and a lot of fixers and a lot of people who aren't necessarily on Dash's level in the sense of like they're sent in to like clean up really nasty problems as they emerge. But they're definitely people whose job is to manage and shape imagery and, you know, all that sort of kind of off, sometimes vaguely scuzzy stuff associated with, I guess, the entertainment industrial complex, for want of a better term.
Yeah, like crisis PR that we've been hearing about more this year.
Exactly. And so, like, a lot of Dash is a lot of those people mushed together. And in fact, there's one story that Dash tells about how he got into the business where he has a friend at the LA DMV, and he ends up paying that guy to help him get celebrities' driver's licenses renewed without those celebrities having to come into the DMV and causing a scene and things like that. And that's a true story. That's based on something that somebody told me.
That's cool.
So there's like little details like that, but he's kind of a mashup of that. He's a little bit of a traditional detective, hard-boiled California hero, like kind of like a Ross McDonald type. Yeah, got kind of more of an aggregation, but Madeline's based on me, essentially.
I love that answer. Yeah. I wouldn't have guessed that.
Just aspects like of it. Yeah.
If I had a million guesses. Yeah, she was cool though. I loved also kind of you're talking about her impulsivity too, though. There's a little bit of it where she's acting not to be gender conformative, but a little bit more like a man than just like the helpless damsel who needs to like ask Dash for help. She definitely had her own agency in figuring out what happened. Try not to say spoilers.
The thing about her that was sort of, and I think if I go back through my notes when I was outlining it, I think it's the word fury or anger that's been like underscored. And like, this is somebody whose father disappeared. Who's angry about a lot of things that aren't necessarily her fault that have happened to her throughout her life. And so her, in addition to like the Navy gray coat and so on, like her rage or her anger is her way of kind of bulldozing through all of that. And in a perverse way, as she and Dash kind of progress on this case, it helps Dash because Dash is not a person who is, he's the match after it's been lit. He's like a burned out cinder on a stick. And I think that her anger helps act as fuel to help power him. And that's sort of the dynamic between the two of them as it emerges. And then because the case is the case that they're trying to uncover is figuring out what happened to her father, whose bones are discovered in a barrel in a dried up lake and in ups, you know, north of LA. Obviously as that case gets resolved, it fixes something more fundamental in her was what I was kind of going for, but anger is definitely like her driving emotion. So that was
not entirely surprised that I loved her is why I'm laughing now. So the like plot wise, what was your inspiration for this story specifically?
A couple years back, there started to be these news stories emerging of how climate change was causing all these, and also water management issues were causing all these lakes to dry up out west, like Lake Mead in Nevada and so on. And as those lakes were drying up, they started discovering mob informants who had been like tossed in there 30 years ago or whatever, which is a great kernel for a mystery. And so I always kept that in my head. And that was kind of the origin of it. And then the rest of it was, I've never written a detective novel before, but I kind of had ideas bouncing around, like using, you know, kind of some of my background as a journalist and so on. So I kind of wanted to use the body in the barrel idea. I wanted it to obviously have a generational trauma aspect and have it, you know, kind of be a very personal thing for whoever was investigating it. And then I wanted to throw in sort of like the Hollywood level to it, kind of the climate change level. I mean, there's just a lot of themes I kind of want to, but the bodies coming out of the dried up lakes was the origin of it, like these real life news stories about it. Yeah.
It is crazy. It was reminding me, I watched Bones a lot, a TV show when it was airing. And there's one like that in Nevada. I can't remember if it's a lake that dries up or something like that, though, where it's like these like places where a lot of like mob related people were just getting dropped off in the middle of the desert. And you are just like, it's kind of creepy to think about. Like there are definitely places all over the place where we haven't even found people.
There's so I used to, I mean, I live in New York City, and I used to live in, a, for those who know New York City, I used to live in Park Slope, which is this neighborhood in Brooklyn. It's called Park Slope because it's like the highest hill, maybe in like the surrounding region, but the bottom of that hill is called the Gowanus Canal. The Gowanus Canal in the 19th century was originally supposed to be this massive wa artificial waterway that was going to allow all the warehouses and so on in Brooklyn to put all their goods on barges and send those
Oh, wow.
barges into New York Bay, where ships, blah, 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 commerce doing its thing. But in the 19th century, they never had enough money to excavate it fully. And so it's a toxic waterway because there's no current clearing things out. And for decades and decades and decades, back when that whole area was an industrial hellhole and then a post-industrial hellhole, it was a place where the mob like dumped guns, where presumably they also dumped bodies and things like that. And so every day when I was going over the teeny tiny little bridge over the Gowanus Canal, I would have that thought, like, oh my God, like if they actually started excavating down here, they'd find an arsenal, and then they would find like probably all sorts of other bad stuff under there, because it's so easy just to like pause on that bridge and just like toss things over. But yeah, I mean, I always had that creepy thought too, where it's like, what's under
Yeah,
here? I think it's just,
I
it's a natural
know.
inclination.
Right. Yeah. Especially if you read and watch lots of crime fiction, you're like thinking about it in those moments. Also, there's even in the synopsis, it's described as darkly humorous, and that is like one of my favorite things in like it, to pair like dark humor with like action or crime or whatever. We actually just saw the movie Novocaine last night, and
Oh, is it
it's
good?
like so good,
Oh,
like
good.
better than I
Cool.
expected,
Nice. Good. I'm looking
and it
forward to it.
like really married those two together. And like literally when we walked out, I was like, I just love action and comedy together. So what was it like kind of like building that voice for this book as well?
I feel like you need humor in, especially when you're doing kind of like darker mysteries. And that's because, I mean, if you read books, some authors can carry this. Some authors can pull this off where you have kind of the same dark note throughout the book that you're just hitting again and again. But if you're not one of those, I think relatively few people, it risks becoming monotonous really quickly, like just like hitting the grim dark note repeatedly until the button falls off. Not great. So because you need to vary it, I mean, humor is obviously the natural way to do that. And it also just makes things lighter. It makes the pace faster. It makes it enjoyable to read. And you need that. You can't just sort of like grind through, you know, and expect that the reader is going to stick with you the whole way. The interesting thing that happened with this book is that in the earlier draft, so when the book begins, Dash, for completely misguided reasons, is trying his hand at stand-up comedy, which a lot of people I know in LA
Oh
and Brooklyn
yeah.
and so on have also tried their
Yes.
hands at. And the reasons become clear later in the book from a psychological perspective why he's doing it. But when I was originally writing it, I tried to make Dash actually genuinely funny. And one of the early drafts I passed to an editor at a fairly large crime imprint, and he was like, I re first he was like, I'm not going to pick this book up because I only had one slot this year and Stephen King took it. And I was like, okay, like that's fine. You can guess, you can guess who this, you can probably guess who this editor is. And then, but he was like, I really like the book. The problem is that Dash isn't funny at all. And so I'm sitting there looking at the manuscript and I'm like, well, humor's first, you get defensive as a writer. So my first impulse
Oh,
was like, well, humor's subjective, like blah, blah, blah.
yes.
And then I sort of realized, like, okay, I get where he's coming from in the sense that this isn't like, you know, Tig Notaro levels of comedy that we're reading here out of this character. And that would probably be distracting. So I was like, okay, what if Dash is really not that great at comedy, at least on stage? Because then it creates this interesting thing where he's clearly failing at this and he needs to transition to a different thing, transition to a different line of work, which then opens the door for the whole detective thing. So there was that impulse to it too. And so like that was kind of Dash's humor level, I was sort of toying with all the way through and kind of playing with the idea that him not being funny actually could help to a certain extent. With Madeline, I think again, I mean, because anger is also perversely, it can be a great driver of humor. I mean, like I was for her, like when she's funny, it just kind of came out just because, like, I don't know. It's just like a maybe it's because it's stemming from part of my personality, but her humor was very easy to write. She's much funnier than he is. Yeah. So I mean, there was that aspect too. But humor is so difficult to like really dial in.
I feel like in books it's a little harder too than like TV or movies. Like you can do so much visually that can be funnier faster. It's a little harder with books.
I've written some columns for McSweeney's, and I have never sweated more over a piece of writing than like the 700, 800 word McSweeney's things that I've done, because it's just so, I mean, I've run into writers who say comedy is easy because comedy is inherently formulaic and you have the formula and then you plug in certain things and then what spit that the human brain is sort of programmed to respond right. to certain patterns in certain ways. And I get that. But when you're actually sitting in front of your blank screen trying to be funny, yeah. I mean, it's difficult. My hat's off to like late night writers rooms and like sitcom writer rooms where you have to like come up with 30 minutes of material constantly. It's horrifying. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And because it needs to be like, if something happened the day before, you've got to like incorporate it. Like, yeah that's got to be a whole other writing environment. It sounds like, so your experience as a journalist was kind of told you about LA or kind of is what informed that. Was there anything else about like writing as a journalist that, either informs this book or just like helps you when you write novels too?
So a lot of the physical path that the two of them follows, they go out of LA and they head north into the fictional town of San Douglas, which is based off Santa Ynez and so on. Every step that they take throughout the book from the very beginning up into the Hollywood Hills through going north and then back down through Santa Barbara and so on is sort of an aggregation of different places I've been in the course of like doing like travel stories in that whole area and doing entertainment stories. So that kind of all plugged in together. More broadly, I've used a lot of what I've done as a journalist to inform fiction, mostly in the context of locations. I don't like writing about a place. I don't like putting my fictional characters in a place unless I've actually been in that place.
Yeah.
And the lucky thing for me is as a journalist, I've traveled to so many different places that I can kind of plug in the reality, or at least a version of the reality, into there. A couple of years back, I had a book called Love and Bullets on an indie crime label called Shotgun Honey. It's a doorstop of a book. I could say it's like 800 pages, and the characters are this married couple, these con artists who go from New York to Oklahoma to Nicaragua to Cuba. Like they do this whole jaunt across North America and Central America before ending up back in New York. Yeah. And that's a lot of that is based on like all the locations there were places I'd actually been. So, I mean, that was useful. In that sense. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I love cons too. So now I need to read that one.
I used to, so I don't smoke, but at one point I got stuck running a cigar magazine for a little bit, a long time ago, like 15 years ago. And so I ended up in like Mexico and Guatemala and Honduras and Cuba and so on repeatedly. Mm-hmm. And so the characters in that book end up in that whole region because they're fleeing a bunch of people in the US. So it helped for that. Yeah. No, I mean, it definitely comes in useful.
Wow. That's so cool. I love that. The other thing with the story that was going on, it sounds like the barrels in the drying up lake were inspiration. Was there anything else like current events wise or anything else about Hollywood and its underbelly that like inspired parts of this?
Yeah, the whole toxic celebrity thing that's been emerging. I mean, obviously with the Me Too movement and all the horrible things with Harvey Weinstein, like is an undercurrent here. And there's a lot of crime fiction and crime nonfiction crime novels and so on are like kind of digesting a lot of aspects of kind of what went on in terms of that. And then in the very beginning of the book, Dash is sent by his former employer to find a Hollywood star who's sort of lost their mind and run off to who knows where with another star. And that was based a little bit off Ezra Miller, a little bit off other kind of Hollywood stars who have sort of lost their mind recently. It just seemed, especially when I was writing at the time, it seemed like there was a bunch of news stories around there. So that became that fuel for that almost pre-credit sequence where he's hunting this person up in the hills. But yeah, I mean, for a long time, there was a lot of bad behavior. And I don't think the reckoning for a lot of that behavior is perfect, but it's definitely going on now. And it definitely mm-hmm. kind of informed a lot of things that were going on. And the thing about this book that, the thing about books in general, about fiction, is that you can achieve a little teeny tiny bit of catharsis, which perhaps isn't present in real life necessarily.
Yeah.
You know, the people who do bad things, unfortunately, don't always get what they deserve. But the good thing about Mm-mm. fiction is that, and you see this in many crime novels, is that fortunately there's a chance for that sort of small level of payback in a certain way. So
yeah, it is. That's an impulse. It's nice, like feeling, not revenge, retribution or whatever for their actions. Even if it's just fictional, it's fun.
Oh yeah, no, totally. Yeah.
That opening part too, when he was having to basically chase someone who had just lost their mind, it reminded me so much, I hadn't even thought of the show in forever, of Entourage and the, like, their manager Ari. That was my first, I think that show was my first introduction into, like, the way that managers are actually working and, like, how they're gonna actually have to handle, like, Hollywood personalities. So it's totally reminded me of that. And Ray Donovan also came after that was so good.
That's a great show.
But with Hollywood and like all the egos and stuff, what do you think makes Hollywood so good for crime fiction as well?
Just because, I mean, there's it's a cliche, but there's the whole level of, you know, you kind of get the shiny front, the incredibly manicured imagery, and then behind it the sheer amount of trauma and so on necessary to kind of keep that the blood that keeps that machine turning in a certain way. And I mean that's an old story. I mean, that goes back all the way to when LA was, you know, a dusty intersection, and, you know, Hollywood was a couple of people in a warehouse in like 1915 or whatever. I mean, that's always been sort of the story of it. The thing that, so when I was an entertainment journalist, I would, like I said, I mean, I would regularly kind of interact with like kind of the RE level managers, but then also, you know, the PR people, the assistants, kind of all the people who help keep the machine running behind the scenes. And the thing that's a huge driver, and this isn't unique to Hollywood, this is the same thing you find in New York publishing, it's the same thing you find to a certain level in government, sort of runs on fear. And, you know, fear that, you know, something's not going to work out, fear that you're going to lose your job because of something, fear that if you produce a certain movie and it fails, like you're going to end up back in Tulsa or something like that before the week is out. And fear makes people do terrible things. Fear will make people instantly overrun any ethics that they thought that they had and do something absolutely terrible. More so probably than any other emotion and so on. And I think that's sort of a big driver of it. And I kind of, with the book, I wanted to layer that fear in to a certain extent, not make it too overt, but just like the sense that everyone's kind of panicked, you know, and everyone's nervous. Yeah. Even the sharks at the top of the.
Right. Pool. Cause it's like someone could turn on you. Cause like even if you're at the top, you're probably with other people who are at the top that know things. It really is. Cause like blackmail or. Even what we've seen with like the Diddy trial is that same thing where it's like you can get people to come over and like have fun and then you have power over them. And it's like, that's not great.
Yeah. And you got to imagine that there's like just the sheer amount of blackmail on the hard drives and everything like that. And the leverage from that is freaky. There's a great, great, great book that I heartily recommend it to everybody. And it's Jordan Harper's Everybody Knows.
I read it right after I read yours.
It's that book is amazing in terms of this, that sort of scorched nerve kind of fear level among everybody. And it's funny because in terms of that book almost deep sixed this book, because what happened was, so I was right. I know Jordan, we're not super friends or anything like that, but like we're friendly acquaintances. We've read in the same lineups at events and things like that. And I knew he was working on something in kind of a Hollywood context right around the time that I was starting to write this. And then I was probably about 50% of the way through the manuscript when Everybody Knows came out. And I bought it on the first day and I read it. And Jordan is such a peerless master of wordsmithing and world building and everything else. And so I read this book and all of a sudden I have like I never have writer's block, but like all of a sudden, like I completely, like the gears completely freeze up. I'm like, oh my God, like the plots are completely different. It's not, there's nothing sort of.
Yeah, they're very different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But there's something about the milieu that he covered that was like, oh my God, like this is sort of like the pinnacle of like this sort of Hollywood underbelly. Like, you know, I can't deal with it. So I froze up for about 2 weeks. And I was reading at a noir at the bar at Shade, which is a bar in the Village in New York that hosts crime fiction writers on a regular basis. And
that sounds cool.
Todd Robinson, who's not only the manager of Shade, but also the great, great editor-in-chief of Thuglit, which is a crime fiction magazine. It's no longer around, but it gave a lot of people like me and Jordan and Sean Cosby and so on their start as short story writers.
Oh, wow.
I'm up there on stage, and before I read from what I was reading at the time, which was a completely separate horror novel, you know, I'm like, oh, like I'm writing this as a tech novel. I just got frozen up because I read Jordan Harper's book, and like, you know, who could possibly compare to that other than like maybe James Ellroy?
Yeah.
And Todd, who's a huge dude, comes like just muscular, like just like he also has been a bouncer, like he's just like a massive guy. Comes marching out from behind the bar, like sticks his finger in my face and like yells like, your thing is perfectly good, like Jordan is doing his thing, you're doing your thing, like I want you to like get back on this book, like blah blah blah. He's just like giving me this like Full Metal Jacket pep talk in the middle of this bar, and that helped break up the mental log jam.
That's so cool.
Which was nice. Yeah, but that book kind of completely froze me in my tracks for 2 weeks. Gosh. It's so good though. Yeah.
What's making me laugh is I have a friend, Hallie Sutton, and she's on the podcast every now and then, and she wrote a really great noir called The Lady Upstairs that also takes place in LA. So she and I are always talking about, she lives in LA too, so we're always talking about Hollywood, noir, like all of that. And she read Everybody Knows sometime last year, and she like got on the podcast and she's like, it's so good. And she was like, I'm just so mad that a man was able to write this. And she was like, how, like, why wasn't mine this good? Like, she was talking about all this. So it's just like fascinating to me too that, this is just happening to like authors that I'm talking to. They're like, yeah, that book just fucked me up for a couple weeks, but it is fantastic. And I love noir so much. So I read yours, and I think I read something else, but I'd had it on my radar where I was like, I want to read this one too. And then I read that and I was like, I'm just lucking out with noir this year. But you're not the only one who has mentioned that about his book.
he's about to do it again too. I belong to a writer's Discord, and a couple people in there have been reading his early readers have been reading the next one, which is a sequel to Everybody Knows. And like,
oh, really nice.
The devastation starting all over again. Like one of my friends was like, I'm so glad I finished writing my book before I read this, because otherwise I would like throw my laptop out the window. I'm like, how could he just, I mean, there's so many authors who consistently deliver with every book, and he's one of them. Yeah, no, it's
and it makes sense, even going back to what we were talking about at the beginning with tropes, is like, there are tropes that I always want, that I always enjoy almost no matter what, like unless the writing itself just isn't connecting with me. But it's like, you do have those tropes that, like, I don't know how many mysteries I've read that take place in Hollywood and how many noirs I've read. And so you do gravitate towards the sameness. But then when you're writing, I'm working on a book that takes place in Hollywood, I've had the same moments where I'm like, there are so many books like this already though. Like, who needs another book like this? But I'm glad you have the people in your life that are like, well, your take on this trope is like what you're wanting to write right now. And it's like, I need to remind myself of the fact that even as a reader, I'm like, I'll still read books that have similar stuff in it. But it's, so we were talking about it, I hear my friend Steph and I were talking too about like, sometimes it's even hard when you finish a book and like are writing a review, because you're like, how do you understand, or how can you tell the things that are going to click with you? And then sometimes they just don't. And you're like, this was supposed to click with me, but it didn't. So there is just like all the different varieties of a trope that can be made.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like, I mean, Sean Cosby's All the Sinners Bleed, which is a great serial killer novel. And I mean, it's ever, especially ever since Thomas Harris wrote Silence of the Lambs, which I guess is, you know, 40 years old at this point or something along those lines, you start to ask yourself, like, how many different variations of a serial killer story can you do? Like, how many different ways can, like, somebody who's cracked in the head, like, murder somebody in hilariously inventive ways? But I think with Sean's book did a really interesting thing of kind of filtering it through the contemporary Southern experience and tackling, you know, racism and the politics and all these other issues, and kind of using the serial killer in that as an avatar almost to tackle those issues. And there's always, I feel like there's, well, maybe not 100% of the time, but 90% of the time, there, you know, despite all the tropes and however many times other people have kind of tread over a certain territory, there's probably some new angle. It's just that becomes the hard part, is finding that thing. And Sean's very good. I mean, Sean, you know, has done like the heist novel, which has also been done to death. That was Blacktop Wasteland. He did the revenge novel, which is Razorblade Tears, and like in every case he's managed to sort of revitalize it by filtering it through that Southern Virginia experience. This is a good example of like kind of how to revitalize something that you would think has been done completely to death.
And his voice is so unique, is kind of what you're talking about too. Like some authors, their voices, even you can feel it in all of the books, even if they're doing different stuff, and sometimes that's what attracts you to it, or like keeps you locked in with the story as well.
Yeah, like Ivy Pachada, have you read her stuff?
These girls, right?
And like Sing Her Down is the newest one. Like she's one where when you think about it, like for example with Sing Her Down, it's that book is all build up. Like there's some action in it, but like really not all that much. But like her voice is so compelling, and her voice is so, she's like Jordan Harper's. Like she's another one where the voice is so compelling and so strong that the voice could carry it through in almost no matter what happens. I mean, there's a lot of action and suspense in that, but
there is.
Yeah, it's more. Yeah, the power
and it was like, it's kind of an old school Western, but it's not. Like it was following that, but I still remember with that one being just so impressed with the way that the character arcs, I'm trying not to spoil it, but the way things come together at the end, I was like, oh my gosh, that's what she was setting us up for this whole time.
It's so well done. She's, I mean, also her short stories too, but her voice is like so strong. It's really amazing.
Yeah. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Well, you've kind of mentioned some books that you loved, but I do always ask at the end if there's anything you've read recently that you've loved. So is there anything you haven't talked about that you read recently?
I mean, speaking of Sean Cosby, I just finished reading an early copy of King of Ashes, which is his next one. And that's, in terms of what you're talking about, revitalizing tropes, is revitalizing like the Godfather crime family trope. Like in the context of that. And that one's really good. I think that one is dropping in June, I think.
I think so. I think it's summery.
When that one's coming out. And then trying to think of other stuff that I've read. That was the most recent. I've been reading a lot of nonfiction lately. So last night I just started that new book by that former Facebook PR person that's like, it's blowing up the bestseller list. It's about like, she tears apart everything behind the scenes.
I know what you're talking about.
And it's funny because it's on my Kindle right now, and I'm Careless People by Sarah Wynne Williams. I didn't get very far into it. I'm only about like 15% of the way through after last night, but like in terms of real life, we're talking about fictional crime and everything else and like fictional skull drudgery, but like in terms of like real life, you know, kind of whether it's true or not. I mean, obviously Facebook would say that this is all a pack of lies, but in terms of like kind of like the real life things that tick behind the scenes that maybe aren't completely on the up and up, I think it's it seems like it's going to be a really good example of it. I really like her prose style is really good. So I would definitely consider that one if you're in the mood for like a nonfiction book.
Yeah.
So those two. Yeah. I think that those are the ones that I've just plowed through in like the last week or so.
Yeah. I'm interested in that. I need to maybe get it as an audiobook. I tend to do better with nonfiction as an audiobook, and I can't do fiction as an audiobook. So
that's fair.
It's just how it rolls.
I can't. It's funny with, I mean, I'm the book club that I belong to. We read a lot of nonfiction. And I always do it as audio, just because you can like do other tasks too, like, you know, wash dishes or build furniture or listen to it. But fiction, I have a hard time with, and I can't listen to my own, like Where the Bones Lie as an audiobook. I can't listen to my own audio, other people read my stuff. And it's nothing against them. Like, they're all like wonderful actors who like do it really well. I just can't, I have this block. I can listen to 30 seconds and then like, I just, something in me like just seizes up completely and I can't do it. So, but I love audiobooks as a format.
I feel the same way that you can. I feel like I can do other things while I listen to nonfiction. And what I've landed on with fiction is like, you have to be building the image in your head. You're not just like learning something. And I think that's, I end up not building the image. And all of a sudden I'm like, wait, how are we here?
I totally see that. Yeah. And like the other thing too is like, if something's occurring, like while the audiobook is playing, you miss, it kind of deletes all of that because, you know, you're not, obviously you have one attention channel and it's only focused on one thing at a time. So
Well, I loved your book. Everyone read it, especially if you love all the things that we talked about. Where can people follow you to stay up to date?
NickKolakowski.com is my website. And then on that website is all the links, which are usually some variation of Nick Kolakowski to like Twitter and Instagram and so on. So
awesome. I will put that link in the show notes, and thanks for chatting with me about your book.
Yeah, this is awesome. Great questions. Thank you so much.